come to order, and also together, I suppose. We're going to hold off on just a second on number one on the agenda. Let's hear from Senator Wieger on Senate File 81, the Metropolitan Council election. Then, Mr. Orfield, if you want to join Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 81 calls for an elected Metro Council. The details for such an election were worked out in Senator Larson's subcommittee and approved by the full state and local government committee. There is nothing in the bill on transportation. There are no powers of the Met Council changed, and so I would stand for questions. I could highlight that the Met Council does provide the region's largest transit system, as you are aware. It's the designated metropolitan planning organization for the region, which is required by the federal government. And it's responsible for selecting projects for federal funding and preparing the three-year transportation improvement plan. There's been some suggestion that, not by myself, but the reason maybe we're before the committee was the suggestion that perhaps this could affect negatively some transportation projects. To dispel that concern or rumor, I do have a letter dated today from Betty McCollum in Congress, which is before you, as well as additional background regarding the FTA, and that this is a non-starter as an issue. I have with me Senator Orfield, or Professor Orfield, who also had worked quite a bit on this subject, and we stand for any questions that you may have.
Mr. Orfield, did you have any testimony that you wanted to provide?
Yes, sir. I'd like to, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of an elected Metropolitan Council. I was a member of the legislature for five terms in the House and one in the Senate, and I was deeply interested in this bill when I was a legislator. I carried this for many years with Representative Pawlenty. We were co-authors of this bill four times in the legislature to make this an elected body. And I am a law professor at the university. I speak on my own behalf as a citizen, not representing anyone but myself. I felt this was a very important issue when I was elected. The basic principle is that when in the United States, when governmental bodies have very large discretionary power and significant taxing authority, the practice is for them to be elected. I've tried to search the country for something that's like this, that is a multi-purpose discretionary authority with significant taxing powers that's unelected. I haven't been able to find anything like this. There are single-purpose special districts that provide for water or provide for sewer separately, but nothing of this magnitude. And I'm just going to show you some of the budget history and talk a little bit about its discretionary powers, and then I'll stand for questions. The size of the Met Council is half the state, the seven-county metropolitan area, and it's got jurisdiction over 187 local units of government with land use planning powers. This is just a map of the region urbanizing over the period. The Met Council's expenditures are $630 million a year. The Met Council spends more per year than every other general-purpose government in the metropolitan area except Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis. This is a budget. There's Hennepin County's budget, which is about $1.7 billion, Minneapolis about $1.1 billion, and the Metropolitan Council $629 million. The Met Council has more bonded debt than every other general-purpose government in the metropolitan area except Minneapolis. It has more bonded debt than the county governments in its seven counties combined. So this shows the city of Minneapolis has larger bonded debt out, but you can see the Met Council's bonded debt is larger than all the seven counties combined. The council's bonded debt is increasing steadily from about $500 million a year in 1991 to more than $1 billion in 2005. This is a graph of the chart. I'll make this available to the committee. I've given it to Senator Wieger, but it's rapidly growing. The Met Council's revenues are 39% from charges, 28% from taxes, 18% from motor vehicle excise tax, 10% from the property tax, 24% from state and federal aid. And this shows the revenue distribution of the council, 39% from charges. Property taxes are $67 million a year. Motor vehicle excise tax, $119 million. The Met Council collects more than $67 million in property taxes per year, more than every other general-purpose government in the metropolitan area except Minneapolis, Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, and Dakota counties. General-purpose is an important distinction because special-purpose local governments are single-purpose districts. When districts are general government, they have broad discretion and authority over many different topic areas. This is like a county or a city or general-purpose local governments. Property taxes, you can see Hennepin County's property tax levy and the City of Minneapolis, the Metropolitan Council. The scope of the council is committed to providing sewer and water treatment and transportation infrastructure to 31% of the area in the seven-county region, expected to grow by increase to 40% by 2030. These are the areas where sewer service has been provided, extending outward. This is the sewer system that it runs, and these sewer decisions are very important toward the development of local units of government. They're deciding which units are going to grow and which units are not going to grow. These are broad discretionary decisions. This is another map. This is my testimony, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm testifying on my own behalf, something I cared about greatly when I was in the legislature. I've tried to search the United States for something that has this kind of general purpose, broad discretionary power that isn't elected, that this has this kind of taxing power. And the only thing I've been able to find is sewer and water districts in the southwest part of the metropolitan area. Now, in France, they have broad regional governments that are appointed, and in Russia, there are broad regional governments that are appointed, elected, that have taxing and spending powers. But I haven't been able to find any in the United States that have this kind of power. And I think generally this is a principle that harkens back to the founding. Taxation and representation need to be connected. Even though there are complicated issues with partisanship and politics, politics gets injected into bodies that have taxing power and discretionary power. This is a danger, I think, in local governments, but it's also a guarantee of liberty. When governments have broad powers that affect people's lives and a multi-purpose general view, in the United States, back to the founding, they have been elected. Single-purpose special districts are often appointed, and they have significant fee-based authorities, but never general-purpose local governments that have broad discretionary power, like municipalities, like counties. The legislature has the power to control the taxing power of the Met Council. It also has the same power over cities and counties. It's very similar. And so this is I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do this as, again, representing my own past. This has been a bipartisan issue in the legislature. Governor Pawlenty, when he was a member of the legislature, and I authored this for many years together. Initially, when the Met Council was created, it was authored by Republicans who wished it to be elected. It failed by a single vote in the Senate in 1967. It has been a bipartisan issue over the years. It's never had a particular party influence.
Thank you. Senator Wieger, did you have anybody else that wanted to testify?
Mr. Chair, for the record, we do have Russ Adams, the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability, is here. Has a statement. I know time is tight. Isaiah, their organization, also is in support, the Sierra Club, and other organizations, but you have the highlights of our arguments and yep. would be willing to yield to Peter Bell.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Mr. Bell,
I take it
you're not supporting this bill.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief, and I am speaking against the bill for a number of reasons. I think Professor Orfield raises a number of important questions, and I'll try to address those and others. First and foremost, I would argue that the proof is in the pudding, and to use a cliche, I think that this, in many respects, is a solution looking for a problem. Never has the Met Council enjoyed more broad-ranging public support than I think it currently does. We do an annual survey in the seven-county area that states that we have the highest approval rating that we have enjoyed since we started taking the survey. Professor Orfield mentioned our taxing authority. We tax about $70 million out of the seven-county region on an annual basis. That is down from about a quarter of $1 billion that we had taxing authority before much of our transit activities moved from the property tax into the general fund. And so that has been reduced. I would also remind you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members, that we have a AAA credit rating, something that I am very proud of. I think that one of the things that the committee and the legislature should always be mindful of is the unanticipated consequences of a of an elected Met Council, and I want to list some of them. Professor Orfield touched on a couple, but let me elaborate very briefly and very quickly. One is the likelihood that an elected council whose districts would be twice as large as Senate districts might get very parochial very quick. In other words, people would run and say, if I don't get my transit stop, you don't get your park. Or if I don't get my wastewater treatment plant or wastewater into my city, you don't get your bus line. And I think that the regional focus that we have been able to maintain, very little of that, incidentally, goes on at the Met Council now, where people say, if I don't get my livable communities grant program, by God, you're not going to get your expansion of your park system. Very little of that happens at the Met Council now. The regional perspective that we are allowed to take, I think, in large measure rests on the fact that we are not elected and would be gone in a nanosecond if, in fact, people ran on platforms to bring certain things home. I think that could be very problematic for the council. There is no guarantee, and this is more specific. I've talked with Mayor Coleman in St. Paul, and he is very, very concerned about the notion of an elected Met Council. We weren't able to get a written statement in time for the meeting tonight, but he is very concerned that an elected Met Council would not necessarily be supportive of rail or transit at all. Currently, there are only four current districts representing the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Coincidentally, 63% of our weekday bus service runs through those four districts. So one has to ask themselves, if 63% of transit service runs through the core of Minneapolis and St. Paul, would the rest of the districts that get elected be as supportive of that? I read with interest the letter from Representative McCollum, supposedly quoting the FTA. I think that really depends on how you ask the question. If you ask the question, should there be an elected or appointed Met Council, I think the FTA is going to say that's a local issue. I think if the question were asked differently, and I think more importantly to the FTA, and say to the FTA, can you guarantee me there will be no delay in funding if, in fact, a Met Council comes into existence and we are then unsure of what the funding stream will be and the commitment of this new governing body, there will be no slowdown in the Central Corridor. I think they would say, no, we can't guarantee you of that fact. That point alone is why Mayor Coleman is very, very concerned about an elected Met Council, because he believes, as I do, that the FTA would say and is looking for reasons to slow down transit projects and would quite likely say, there is now questions about the commitment for the Central Corridor. There is questions based on a changing governance structure. There's questions about continued funding and support of the Central Corridor. And we're going to wait until the dust settles. I would encourage the committee to ask the FTA for that assurance that there will be no slowdown in support of the Central Corridor were there an elected Met Council. I feel confident they would not provide that kind of guarantee. Finally, Mr. Chair, the federal law provides that we have a metropolitan planning organization for this region through which federal funds flow. The MPO, as it is known, is created by agreement between the governor and elected officials representing at least 75% of the metro area. Since MPOs must have elected representatives, we have established the Transportation Advisory Board, which has 33 members, 17 of whom are elected officials from city and county governments. Those 17 members are made up of one county board member from each of the seven metropolitan area counties and 10 elected officials, including one from each city of the first class, appointed by the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. If the Metropolitan Council were elected, there would at least be two questionable, unfortunate outcomes. First, the Met Council could continue to be the MPO, and the TAB would be eliminated, which eliminates that board and the local government representation. Or the Met Council would lose its MPO designation. The effects of this outcome would have significant impacts on how federal funds for road and transit projects would be processed, because another MPO would have to be established for the region. It is anticipated that major delays would be the best-case scenario for any regional projects currently in the federal funding process. For example, under this bill, our region would be changing to an elected council at a very critical junction for the Central Corridor Light Rail project. In late 2008, we hope to be going to the Federal Transit Administration for approval of final design. The FTA will commission a full review of the project at this time. They will look at government structure, management organizations, and budget and finance issues. If this bill passes, I am certain that the FTA will not approve our application to move into final design as planned in the fall for 2008, because the newly elected council would be under no obligation to honor any of the previous council's decisions on the Central Corridor. I think that this does interject a bit of uncertainty to it. This, again, is why city officials are concerned about it. Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Questions from the committee? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How come the other guys got here? We got stuck in traffic. I don't know what happened. But in any case, that's a Met Council issue.
They took the high-speed bus.
Oh, okay. In Chisago County, one of the greatest fears in Chisago County is that we might become part of the Metropolitan Council. And people believe that, you know, they see government without representation. To them, it's a big deal that, you know, so much of land use planning, you know, the MTC and all of this big dollar stuff is being regulated by people who are not elected officials. And in Chisago County, I know that is a very big issue. And I'm hearing what you're saying, but to me it seems like why wouldn't we support having these folks be elected?
Mr. Chair, Senator, first of all, I want to be very clear. Since I have been chair of the Met Council, I have never proposed that we expand the jurisdiction of the Met Council. I have said I meet with representatives from the adjacent counties a couple of times a year to talk about issues of mutual interest. I am very open to an interest in joint powers agreements that might allow us to do things like park and rides in the adjacent counties and maybe collaborate on some park issues strictly on a voluntary basis. The reason why I oppose an appointed Met Council is I think there are unanticipated consequences that would affect the counties that are currently a part of the Met Council, many of which I have articulated today. But there is no intention that I would have, at least under my chairmanship, to expand the jurisdiction of the council. And I think these unanticipated consequences are real. I think they are likely to happen. And one of the most important parts of it, when I became chair of the Met Council, many of the 189 units of government that are part of it, one of their biggest concerns was this. They didn't want huge ebb and flow from our land planning functions. They didn't want us to go from pillar to post in terms of our land planning activities. If you had an elected council, you would, in my judgment, have a council that would swing from the right to the left, depending upon election. That's exactly the opposite of what local mayors want when they're operating under one set of, they do a 10-year planning, they have a 10-year time horizon for their planning. The thing they really don't want is to have one set of rules for one 10-year period and a radically different set of rules when a new council gets elected for the next 10-year period. Almost to a person, mayors said, we want a degree of continuity, Peter, in the land planning functions, and we don't want a body that moves from pillar to post, which I think is exactly who would make up the council. You would have strong individuals with very passionate feelings across the political spectrum running for the council. That would create a bifurcated council that I think would not serve this region well.
Thank you. Mr. Bell, And I appreciate that the council has not tried to snag up other counties, whether it's Senator Olsen's county or Goodhue County or wherever. What about the transit taxing district? When are we going to expand that to include the actual boundaries of the metropolitan region?
Mr. Chair, I think that that's a great point. For other committee members, only part of the metropolitan area is included in the transit taxing district. The transit taxing district is a tax on property tax that pays off some of our bonds for our capital. And there is a concern by many members within the transit taxing district that they are being unfairly treated. Quite candidly, I think that's the case.
I think they have a legitimate argument.
I think they have a legitimate argument based upon that. In current law, the difficulty is that a city has to raise their hand and say, we want to be included in part of the transit taxing district. Because only 3 to 5% of any municipality citizens use transit, and 100% of their citizens would be taxed, it is very hard for a mayor or a city council to raise their hand without a quid pro quo, and are expressly saying we'll provide service that may not be the right time or the right service to provide. It is our hope that the legislature would take a look at this and explore addressing this. I have had this conversation with the governor. He understands the issue. He has made no commitment to me to change this, but certainly understands the problem. And my hope is that we will resolve this in the not too distant future.
Okay, we've got Senator Saltzman and Senator Skoy.
And on the point of continuity, Mr. Chair, if I could just go back to that, perhaps I missed this earlier, but in your closing comments, Mr. Bell, you talked about the fact of what would happen if there was, you know, a newly elected Met Council and they wouldn't have to uphold the plans for the Central Corridor. Well, that's exactly the case, I would guess, for why we should have an elected Met Council, because right now if we have a change in our governor in 2010, we could have a whole new Met Council, too, without any commitment, whereas this might provide some continuity and then stability and not this, turnover, as well as people coming from the community. I guess the concern I have is that people who are appointed for really, political reasons, and hopefully that there is great thought put into that. But I represent an area of the Twin Cities, which is Lake Elmo, and they have some very strong concerns about the Met Council, but I think that they would have felt better if they had had an elected official that came from their community, who had roots in their community, who the people said, this person, it could be, 49 to 51, but at least I feel that they had roots in my community, they will speak for me. And I think that's the sense, that this is not about politics, it's really about continuity. And I guess that same concern is that, again, if we're concerned about ongoing commitment, if our funds are, at stake here, what happens with a governor that changes or who changes, and then we have a whole new Met Council, and then we really don't know where we're going.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, I think that the issue that you are addressing, quite candidly, could be appropriately addressed in another way, which is having staggered terms for the Met Council, and then you deal with the issue of a changeover in the governor, point one, and still provide a degree of continuity. I would make perhaps a slightly different argument on Lake Elmo. I think that the resolution that we got to Lake Elmo was the Met Council working at its best. I'm not sure if an elected Met Council where you had one member from that district and 15 members from a different place would not do something like, I'll resolve the Lake Elmo issue if I get my part in my district, if I get my transit stop in my district. I'm not sure we want those really parochial interests driving what our transit system looks like. I'm not sure if we want those very localized parochial interests driving what our wastewater system looks like. I'm not sure if we want those parochial interests driving what we want our park system to look like. It's the exact antithesis of why the Met Council was set up, which is to be able to take a regional approach. We deferred, frankly, as chair of the Met Council, I deferred a bit more to the local officials for the very reason you stated, because they were elected. And I said, you know, I think there is a balance here between efficient use of infrastructure and the rights of local communities to do what they darn well please. And they are elected, so we're going to be somewhat deferential. You have an elected body, another elected body, that says we have our own election certificate as well, and we're going to ram something down Lake Elmo's throat. They got one member standing up against it. They got 15 other members with an election certificate that I think would not be constrained at all.
Mr. Orfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond to a few points. One is that this would cause an upheaval in the Federal Transportation Administration's view of the MPO. The federal statute that requires metropolitan areas with more than 50,000 people to have metropolitan planning organizations states that they should be composed of elected officials. Now, our Metropolitan Council has to get a special waiver from Congress every 4 years, because it's the only MPO in the United States that isn't composed of elected officials. Now, most of them are local elected officials that are appointed. So we have two bodies, one composed of elected officials that are local officials, and one of the Met Council, and we have two bodies because the federal law requires that one of them be elected officials. In my reading of the federal statute, this would be a much more direct path toward satisfying the requirements of the federal statute, having a directly elected body. This is what the Congress, I think, wanted to happen and isn't happening here. And in most places of the country, there is a local elected officials compose this. Now, the second issue is about parochialism. And these are serious concerns and not to be minimized. But these are the same issues that are at stake at the legislature. These are the issues that the framers discussed when they created the United States. Is, you know, some people thought that we should have an appointed Senate, that the president should appoint the Senate, and that they should serve for life because they would be the great men of the nation, and that they would be beyond parochial interests. And others of the framers said, but what if they're not good men, and what if they aren't accountable? And in the United States, local elected governments, local governments that have broad discretion and taxing powers are elected not because they're more efficient, but because this is a fundamental principle of democracy. Democracy, as we know, isn't efficient, but it's a check against abuse of power. And these are I have tried to find a general purpose local government in the United States that has this broad discretionary power that there's this, and I haven't, I don't think that this is a, I haven't found one. Now, in France, they have bodies like this that are appointed and supervise the regional authority, and in other countries, but not in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so these are the...
Senator Scoy, and then we have another person that wants to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I must be the only person in the room that didn't know this, but I think Senator Salzman answered my question. Mr. Bell, I'm assumed that the entire Met Council turns over at the governor's election. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bell, there would be pretty significant disruption to continuity at that election.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. Though I, in answering Senator Saltzman's question, I said that staggered terms would address it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, can I make one quick point?
Sure, Mr. Bell.
One of the things I think the committee needs to consider is the arguments that were made regarding the Met Council. If, in fact, it was an elected Met Council, this would be, I think, an extremely powerful body. Its budgets, I think, as you said, would be larger than virtually any municipality's budget. Its debt significantly larger. Its districts twice as large as Senate districts. They would feel little need to be deferential to the legislature, which I think the current Met Council does, little need to be deferential or work with the governor, as the current Met Council does, little need to be deferential to local units of government like the current Met Council does. You would have an extremely powerful body that has a huge budget, huge powers, and no need to cooperate with local units of government, counties, elected officials, or the administration.
And Mr. Bell, the last time I checked, the legislature gives you the authority to tax, and we could also take it away.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Sieben, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We want to wrap this up. Okay. Everybody knows how they're going to vote here. So,
okay.
Senator Sieben.
Well, I'm sorry. I'll try to keep my my point short, and I think Senator Saltzman and Senator Skoy touched on this. But, Chair Bell, if you're very concerned about the, as you said, the pillar-to-post swing between moving to an elected Met Council, it would seem to me that if there was some accountability to voters, that areas of the metropolitan area that, for instance, were huge supporters of transit would probably elect in a legislator a council member who is supportive of that and then keep them there if they acted in the citizens' best interest. So I guess, and the reason that this bill is so appealing to me is that I would like to see more of the Met Council members become advocates for transit, for instance. Right now, I feel as though many of the Met Council members feel as though they're serving at the pleasure of the governor and are unwilling to go out and advocate for transit projects or really advocate for the region as a whole. And, this is contrary to what you said, I think, but I think that an elected body, members would have more willingness to speak their mind and to advocate for what their constituents really feel. So, and then I'm also, my second point is I'm glad to hear that you feel that the Met Council is deferential to the legislature. I hope you'll continue to take our message here that, for instance, the Central Corridor, which you bring up, in sort of a manner that this bill could threaten the future success or implementation of the Central Corridor. But I also then urge you to hear what many of us around this table have said, that the Central Corridor absolutely must go to the Union Depot, and I hope you'll show us that same deference and listen to that message that, that's not negotiable for many of us. And sorry, I'm beating a dead horse here, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator Sieben. Senator Olson, and then we're going to hear from Mr. Flores, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Oilfield, I in principle agree that the power to tax should go with elected bodies. But the last time I checked, the property tax wasn't getting any more popular. And I think there ought to be less burden on the property tax. And frankly, I'd rather take away that power to tax, especially from the property tax. And I think we ought to be looking at other ways to fund the planning and the organization that affects such a major part of this state. And that's the way I'd rather work, because I, frankly, the size is part of it, but there's not great visibility from the standpoint of holding accountable. In fact, I have been amazed at some of the complaints that I hear about local government where people aren't paying attention to their own and holding their own local officials accountable at a much smaller scale. I think this would be not within most people's radar, other than the activists who make it their business. And so I share the concerns that I'm not sure the elected council would achieve what you think it would.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Let's have the testimony from Mr. Flores. If somebody would mind giving up their seat. I think he's bigger than all three of you, so.
Or wait a minute, does he or doesn't he?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jason Flores. I'm here today representing the Metropolitan Coalition of Chambers, an association of 25 metro area chambers of commerce representing business in more than 60 communities. MCC formed 5 years ago as an advocate for significant investment and improvement in the Twin Cities' multimodal transportation infrastructure. MCC has worked primarily on transportation funding issues here at the legislature, but we have also monitored regional governance issues as they relate to transportation. We have, since our formation, advocated for better coordination and integration of transportation projects in the metro area, and we fully support the current plan as presented by the Metropolitan Council. MCC has several concerns with the proposal to elect the Metropolitan Council. Many of them will echo points made by Mr. Bell. First, we support increased coordination and cooperation in the transportation system. This bill would not help achieve that goal. Instead, it would add yet another level of complexity and compound already competing interests. Currently, the council works very well with local elected officials. If the council were elected, it could lead to unnecessary political tensions and increased parochialism that would interfere with long-term planning efforts. Independent elections for the Met Council would also harm the strong working relationships in place between the administration, any administration, and the council, which could further delay policy implementation. As Mr. Bell mentioned, changing the governance structure just as several large projects are coming online could potentially delay future construction and lead to loss of federal funds to other competing metro areas. Finally, Mr. Chair, the current structure of the Metropolitan Council already allows for sufficient political responsiveness and accountability without directly exposing council members to the pressures of electoral politics. We've recently experienced the difficulty in addressing transportation funding through the political process. Meanwhile, development of long-term strategic plans has moved forward with wide approval of the results. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, we have serious concerns with this bill and believe that the current system of appointment for the Metropolitan Council best serves the transportation needs of the metro area as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flores. I just might want to point out that a delay in receiving the federal money is only going to happen if we fail to pass a funding package this year.
And Mr. Chair, we also have a proposal about transportation funding on the table. I hope you'll be receiving that letter later this week.
Great. I hope that it has a dedicated revenue source for transit.
It does.
Great. With that, Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen has moved that.
Mr. Chair, just one question, if I may.
Senator Dahl.
On the, I was looking at the Sierra Club letter here, and I noticed myself, the council chair, has a term in here, but you've said 1 year in your proposal, the legislative bill here. What's the purpose behind that besides instead of a 2 year term for the chair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl. 1 year was recommended, as many local governmental units usually elect their officers on an annual basis.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Senator Wieger, is it currently a 2 year term? 4 year term.
4 year term for the chair.
Okay.
But that is an appointment, Mr. Chair, Senator, by the governor. In this proposal, it would be the elected members deciding amongst themselves on chair.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Olsen has moved that Senate File 81 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on the Environment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Wieger. Next up, we need to adopt the subcommittee report from Senator Dibble's Budget Division. This is in regards to Senator Sieben's bill on high-speed rail, Senate File 223. All in favor of the adoption of the subcommittee report, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Next up, we're going to hear from Senator Day on the governor's transportation funding bill. Senator Day, Senate File 541.
Mr. Chairman, thank you and committee members for listening to the governor's funding package, and I take it that tomorrow you're going to listen to the total budget. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to you about transportation. I think it behooves all of us to come up with something that is workable and that we can put some dollars into our transportation. You all know, and I know, that we have a lot of roads that need repair, and we need to get on with getting those fixed. I do want to mention a couple things, because I think as Mr. McFarland next to me will testify about the details of the bill, have taken probably the governor and the lieutenant governor to task many times over the last summer, and I'll tell you why. Because they're doing an absolutely terrible job of telling the people of Minnesota how well they've done. I was here under Carlson administration 8 years, didn't do anything. I was here under Ventura administration 4 years, and he sucked $177 million out in the license plates. I will tell you that 2005, we had the largest transportation bill ever. I look at I-94 and the 694 and the Boulevard, Brooklyn Boulevard, Highway 100 North to 394, the I-394 HOV lane, I-394 westbound auxiliary from Louisiana out 169, France Avenue, Highway 5, Wakota Bridges, McKnight Roads, just a whole host of things. And in greater Minnesota, Highway 371 north of Little Falls, 53 in Duluth, 52 in Rochester, 63 in Rochester, Highway 14 down in my area, Spicer and Highway 336 and up in Moorhead. And for some reason, they don't seem to ever get much credit for this. Why, I don't know. The other thing that's happened, and somebody mentioned it over here, ingestion has gone down from a peak of 293 miles in 2003 to 267 in 2006. Now, that's not a big group, but it's gone down, and Department of Transportation is coming out with a brand new study. And also what's happened is we also had like 482 fatalities, which is the lowest we've had since World War II in the state of Minnesota, and nobody is saying anything about that. Senator Murphy and your committee,
I am.
You should take credit for it. Right, you
well,
should.
Well, I'm not taking credit for it. I give the credit right back there to the State Patrol and other law enforcement.
But I think in our committee we have done some things that help with that. And it was interesting to me, and I was sorry that I missed Congressman Oberstar, who we all know is a leader in transportation issues in the United States, been very active in all sorts of transportation. And he came before us and he said, well, if you guys would put together a sales tax, a gas tax, and put the money together, then we'd send it back to you. You know, it's been since 1992 since the federal government has ever put a tax in. I mean, so I started digging up some things about the federal gas tax was last raised, 1993 by 4.3%, 4.3 cents. They put it into the federal general fund. And then following the increase the following year, they took 6.8 cents out of it, out of the gas transportation fund, and they put it into the general fund. And they're at 18.4, and we're at 20. And then in 1997, they have now put all 18.4 cents back into the federal gas tax transportation. But it was interesting because the other thing that's interesting is we send them, we are now a donor. We are a donor to the federal government. It used to be they sent us money. Not anymore. We send them a buck, they send us back 87 cents. We should have asked him, well, you know, Congressman Oberstar, send us some money back. We're sending you a buck, at least break even. So, and we don't need to get into his highway project because that
number that you stated, 87 cents, would be disputed by Representative Oberstar. When he was here, he said that number was, I believe, 96 because of the last authorization of iced tea Lou or whatever. It took into consideration the ethanol.
Well,
because you was using the same numbers, and he told me I was wrong. So,
okay. I don't think it behooves any of us to get in any arguments with somebody that's very influential. We want him on our side, but it is interesting when somebody says, well, you guys go do a gas tax, and wait a minute, you haven't did one in 15 years. You're telling us to do one. And the other one that was interesting, and we'll get off of that, but he talked about Highway 53, $50 million, and then we aren't, the state of Minnesota doesn't have the matching money. It has like 2,000 cars on it. About 2,000 cars on it, $50 million. I hope I hope that never does our Department of Transportation have to match up to the federal government telling us to spend millions of dollars on highways that have no cars. Senator Vickerman, I guess, is no longer here, but on Highway 60, they have like, 6,200. Down in my area, we have 8,800. And so, so be it. But it's interesting when they say there isn't matching funds. The reason there isn't matching funds is because the money is coming for projects that don't match up with the state of Minnesota. And don't you think that we should use our expertise of our people that work for our highway department to put together the projects, and then hopefully they will help us get some money and match up with those. But we are here tonight to talk about our plan. It's the governor's bill. I believe it's a good bill. Doesn't raise taxes. Doesn't ask anyone who doesn't buy a car or a truck to pay a cent for roads and transit. I think it's a fiscally sound plan to make the best use of existing revenue for our benefits. Now, I think it's also a clean, easy bill that something we can do. Some people say, well, Dick, you're taking money from my kids' future and bonding, and I've heard your grandfather, you're going to have kids. You heard this whole bit. Hey, what's the difference between building a swimming pool or a bike trail or not fixing buildings? So that's one thing. We do $1 billion in bonding around here a year. There's no difference in spending money through bonding than there is on roads than there is for anything else. So I've never, I say, hey, it has never bothered me. And I think that, last year I think we voted for $990 million worth of general obligation bonds for, a whole host of things. So I think that we could, bonding I don't think is bad when it comes to roads. And I think even the chairman and his bill, I remember last year we had like $1.7 billion in bonding.
Right, and the House said that they didn't want to accept that.
I know.
I don't understand what they were thinking.
Mr. Chairman, they weren't like us. We're going to have to bring them along a little bit. I think that also, basically, and this is, and Mr. McFarland will explain the bill in some more of the detail, but I think the main thing to remember is that we can do $1.7 billion worth of projects. And I, somewhere along the list, maybe I have them somewhere, all the different projects that are here.
Well,
that's it. But somewhere we'll try to get that to you. That has all the different projects, the $1.7 billion worth of projects. And it's a 10-year bonding program. Debt service paid with the recently passed constitutional amendment using some of those funds. And basically, those revenues generate about $4.5 billion. We're also making a one-time $100 million general fund appropriation for state highways, and there are $651 million for Greater Minnesota and $650 million for the Twin Cities metro area. I think this is a good package. I thought it was a good package last year. We had some semblance of the same package, but we've changed it a little bit to make it more compatible and easier to do. I think also one of the things that we as legislators and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you putting together your package, and everybody will have a package. And this is just another version of something that I think is doable. And I think that it's something that we can take a look at. And at this time, I would like to have Mr. McFarland kind of go through some of the details. As you all know, I'm not the biggest detail man, but I try.
But you paid your $100, Senator Day.
I know that. Yep.
Mr. McFarland, maybe you can hit the high points of the bill. I think that Most of the folks around the table, except for the newly elected folks, have probably heard a lot of what's in here before. But if you want to hit the highlights, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to Senator Day for inviting me here to discuss the points. And I will just go through the high points and wait for questions and discuss them in more detail if you would like. Most of the concepts in the governor's plan for this year have been before the committee over the last couple of years. The governor's financing plan has six major components. The first, as Senator Day referenced, is a $1.7 billion 10-year bonding program designed to accelerate projects throughout the state, both in the metro area and greater Minnesota. Debt service on the bonds would be paid for entirely by revenues from the new revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund from the constitutional dedication of the motor vehicle sales tax. The governor has highlighted 25 projects across the state, 23 in greater Minnesota and two specific projects in the metro area so far that could be accelerated with this bond package. Secondly, the governor has proposed a $100 million general fund one-time appropriation to the Trunk Highway Fund, and that appropriation serves two purposes. First and foremost, that appropriation is designed to return the Devil's Triangle project in the metropolitan area to its construction schedule this year in the wake of putting forward the Crosstown project for advertisement earlier this winter. So the Crosstown project is out for bid. A temporary shift in the metro program had to be made in order to make the paperwork on Crosstown work with the federal government, and this $100 million infusion from the general fund would return Devil's Triangle to its schedule for construction this year. The remainder of that $100 million would go to projects throughout the state to keep them on schedule in wake of the recently lower than previously forecasted revenues for gas tax, tab fees, and motor vehicle sales taxes. So it's a plan to keep projects on schedule. Thirdly, the governor in his package proposes distribution of the motor vehicle sales tax constitutional amendment. The legislature must appropriate those new motor vehicle constitutionally dedicated motor vehicle sales tax funds to roads and transit. The governor is proposing 60% of the funds go to local and state highways, local roads and state highways, and 40% to transit. The local road and state highway portion would go to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund to be distributed in the same manner as gas tax and tab fees are distributed to local jurisdictions and the State Trunk Highway Fund. The governor has proposed on the transit side that 38% of the transit funds go to the metropolitan area and 2% go for rural transit. The governor has also proposed dedicating the sales tax on leased vehicles as a transportation revenue stream, and he would do so by adding the sales tax on leased vehicles to the base of the motor vehicle sales tax pot of money that will be constitutionally dedicated for transportation. He simply adds that amount of money to the MVEST base and then distributes it via the constitutional amendment and as was passed in the fall. That one item adds $450 million to roads and transit over the next 10 years. The governor has also proposed to exempt certain trunk highway fund expenditures from paying the sales tax, the state sales tax. That saves the trunk highway fund about $4 million a year. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the governor has proposed from that $100 million general fund appropriation to use $5 million of that appropriation to begin a pilot project in Minnesota for testing technologies that can shift us to a mileage-based tax system in Minnesota rather than a gas tax-based tax system. It is an important issue for the future of transportation funding across the country, and the governor would like to see Minnesota at the forefront of testing the strategies and the technologies that will get us there as quickly as possible. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer questions about any elements of the governor's plan.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland. Mr. McFarland, on the last item that you touched on, what are the have you had any discussions with the feds on what they're looking at as far as a mileage-based tax?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have. Minnesota has already done some work not in the field, but some policy work, some conceptual work with some federal funds on mileage-based taxation and other innovative taxation and fundraising issues. There are two states in the country that are pursuing different types of pilots to jumpstart this kind of idea. I think the goal, but quite frankly, this is a federal issue, and I think the goal that the one of the goals that the governor has in this pilot is to try and push the federal government along a little bit more quickly than they might otherwise pursue this on their own. The more states that start to jump on this idea of shifting from gas tax-based taxing systems to mileage-based and using technology and some of the advantages that exist there, the federal government might be more apt to move these concepts along more quickly, because it really has to be implemented nationwide by the federal government and have the states follow, because it certainly isn't going to work if the federal government has a gas tax-based system for federal transportation funding and states try and do a mileage-based tax system on their own. But it's an attempt to demonstrate that it can be done, demonstrate it to citizens and the federal government, and urge them to act more quickly than they otherwise might have.
Mr. McFarland, I do believe that we need to experiment with some of the technology that's out there and to try to get our arms around that technology. There's a lot of discussion amongst folks who hold the privacy issue pretty near and dear. And, you know, we want to make sure that every allowance is made to make them feel comfortable, too. So I think that that's probably going to be somewhere in our final funding package as well.
And, Mr. Chairman, we're very, members of the committee, we're very cognizant of the policy issues around this concept. And those, what we're trying to do in this particular pilot is not solve all the policy issues or some of the social issues that might be, you know, that might need to be discussed around the issue. We want to identify them and begin the process of identifying them for discussion, while at the same time the pilot is really focused on the technology side and demonstrating that it can work.
Mr. McFarland, on the last page of this long handout here, you've got the debt service for the $1.7 billion in highway bonding. Now, the from the right, can you explain what the 0% is in the second column from the right, and then the zeros from the third column from the right?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What we tried to do is, you saw a similar chart in your committee last year, so we tried to make this chart as similar as possible. Mm-hmm. What those two columns with zeros demonstrate is that the governor's plan does not require any money for debt service on this bonding package other than the money that comes from the motor vehicle sales tax constitutional amendment, the new revenues that will come to the Trunk Highway Fund from that amendment. And let me explain. Mm-hmm. There, on the far right column with the green and the red numbers, mm-hmm. the green numbers represent those years where the motor vehicle, the new revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund that will come to the, or the new revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund from the motor vehicle sales tax amendment exceeds the assumed debt service in that year. So in 26 of the 30 years shown on this chart, the new revenues exceed the debt service on the $1.7 billion of bonds. There are 4 years there, as you see in red numbers, where the debt service exceeds the presumed new revenues in that particular year. What this plan would do, it would manage the first handful of years in green in such a fashion as to bank enough motor vehicle sales tax new revenues to cover those small shortages in those 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McFarland, is there some language in the bill that kind of sets up an account to put some of this in to cover those? This chart looks a lot better than it did last year, I'll tell you that right now. But is there some language in the bill that sets up a dedicated fund that would pay those 4 years?
Mr. Chairman, look over my shoulder to our CFO or I don't believe so. I believe it's a. It was no. I just okay. checking. I don't. It's a management philosophy to mm-hmm. to do that. And if I could just point out, in the second from the left column, over the 30 years, the new, and these are based on pretty conservative assumptions, but of revenue growth, new revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund as a result of the trunk of the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax Constitutional Amendment will total $4.37 or so billion dollars over those years. The debt service on $1.7 billion in bonding will total $2.5 billion over those 30 years, which means the governor's plan will provide $1.8 billion of new motor vehicle sales tax revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund that are available for things other than bond debt retirement.
Okay, Senator Salzman.
You know, I am new to some of this bonding stuff, but let me just ask if I'm reading this right. So this $1.7 billion highway proposal would cover potentially the projects that are here.
Yes.
And this spreadsheet says that, though, that this set of projects, which is what is going to be done right now in the next, you know, four years, we'll be paying for that through 2038 and basically almost using, you know, well over half of the MVEST funds to fund that those bonds, correct?
Yes.
Over half. So over the course. But
no, we'll be using 1.8 of – no, I'm sorry. You're correct, Senator. I'm sorry.
So what I'm trying to get at is that in, you know, 2 years if I'm at this table and we have, other projects to be done and we're going to look for money to pay for them, we can't turn to the MVEST. We'll have maybe some of this here. But if we use bonding for the next set of projects, we basically used up the MVEST funds for the next 20-some, 30-some years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, yes. There are clearly, and we've indicated that in testimony over the in the past, there are limits, and you have to be responsible in your bonding packages, and you have to manage them well. Some states in the country have done a very good job of managing their bonding packages. Some have not. We think we have learned from them. We believe it's important, and we've been through the bonding debate for a number of years now, and we've all learned a little bit more from the bonding that was done in 2003 and from the testimony and the legislative debate that has gone on since. It's important to have a dedicated stream of new revenue to help support your bonding packages. The governor's plan, when first introduced, dedicated this new stream of revenue, the MVEST money to the Trunk Highway Fund, for this bonding package. And that's a very important concept in pursuing such bonding packages.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, just one more question then. But I guess that when, you know, the MVEST was passed, there is this misperception that it's going to take care of all these needs. And I guess what I'm going back to is that we're using MVEST funds to take care of maybe projects this year and next, and then after that, we don't have these dollars to go to again until maybe after 2039, which by then we'll all be driving hybrid cars and won't have a gas tax.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would dispute that a bit in this way. If you look at the later years, as you get, and I know it's a lot of years out, but as you get into 2030. We're into over $100 million in additional MVEST revenue that is not needed for debt service. Those are those green numbers. But Senator, the reality is that with these 25 projects that are waiting for money come right off of MnDOT's priority project lists throughout the districts. These are not handpicked for any particular reason. And one way or the other, these MVEST funds are going to be going to these projects because these are the priority projects. You can either try and fund these projects with MVEST funds using cash on the barrel, or you can leverage the money and try and build the projects sooner. The reason leveraging works is that we have construction inflation in the highway industry running at double digits, 10, 12, 15%. And we can borrow at the state bonding level at rates less than 5, 4%. And so we can actually do more with the MVEST money by bonding and accelerating these projects. We can do more of these projects than we could if we tried to fund all these projects by waiting for the cash to accumulate, the cost of the projects going up, and then trying to pay for it on a cash on a barrel basis. But the real value of the bonding is the ability to accelerate the projects faster, beat inflation, leverage the money, and provide the projects to the public and enjoy the benefits far sooner than you otherwise would be able to by just paying cash on the barrel.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McFarland, I was back to the graph for the MVEST fund, and so these the column next to the years where it says new MVEST for Trunk Highway Fund and lease sales tax, what kind of growth assumptions did you use to come up with the rest of these numbers for both the lease sales tax and the MVEST money? I can understand the first 5 years where we're phasing it in, but then afterwards,
as you see, Mr. Chairman, it is pretty flat over time. What we've done for both the sales tax on leased vehicles and for the MVEST is we've taken the latest budget forecast, latest November forecast, we took the actual Department of Finance projections per year as far as they went. I think they went out to 2009 or 2010. And then the rate of increase in both the leased vehicle sales tax and MVEST was 2% annually. And that's the model we used.
But, Mr. McFarland, their numbers were off. I mean, that MVEST money is we're losing actual dollars, and they keep saying that. And that's why I asked, finance keeps saying that it's going to keep growing, and it's last 3 or 4 years it actually lost money. So.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that concern. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the governor's, you'll see in this plan is that the bonding is phased in. It's not 1.7 the first year, and then you're mm-hmm. committed. A bonding program like this has to be managed. And none of us knows exactly what's going to happen with MVEST over the next 10 years or the next 15 years. We tried to take very conservative assumptions. We took assumptions that those revenue streams would grow, but they would grow at very low rates, trying to be conservative with the model. But absent a crystal ball that gives you better information than the Department of Finance and historical growth, it's a conservative model we could come up with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. McFarland, I'm not the hugest fan of highway bonding, but I think that Mr. Bernson has come up with a way that we can actually do bonding, not on an unlimited basis, but on a limited basis, and it pays for itself with certain trigger mechanisms. I've always been a little hesitant about getting into the cycle where we're always reauthorizing bonds. Hasn't worked in New Jersey, hasn't worked in Virginia, and if we stretch ourselves too far out in a bonding program, and I think you will agree with this statement, is that sooner or later we're going to be eating up all of our gas tax revenue just to service bonds. It's happened already in two states that, kept reauthorizing bonds and more bonds and more bonds. And I think that there's a definite need in the state to have bonding. I mean, I've been going through the long-range transportation plan and the rest of the documents that the department has sent over in the last couple weeks, and it appears to me that just in bridges alone, we're going to need, over the next budget cycle, we're going to need a couple $400 or $500 million to cover just bridges. So there is a place for bonding, and as you said, we need to be able to manage that bonding to balance that with where we're going to apply our debt service. The one thing about the debt service that I might want to mention to the members is that for every dollar that we have on debt service and don't have a dedicated stream to pay for that debt service is a dollar that we're peeling off that CASA formula, basically, or taking out of our maintenance budget. And both of those options are not real palatable, knowing that most of the roads out there are not state trunk highways. So, but there are a couple portions of the plan. And like I said, I don't want to just rail on the bonding, because like I said, there is a need to do bonding. We've got a lot of bridges around here that a Lowry Street bridge could, it's not in very good shape, needs to be replaced. And I mean, we can just look up, you can go out to the front steps of the Capitol and start looking up and down the river and start counting the bridges that are going to need to be replaced. Senator Sieben has one down there in her district on Highway 61, and that thing is not only a deficient bridge, but it's also a terrible hazard. There's been two people killed there in the last 3 weeks, I believe, and it's time for that bridge to go and put something in that is a little more modern and one that the State Patrol can actually utilize their services there, because some of the things going on coming in and out off that bridge are obscene. But there are portions of this bill that that are we're going to need to do them, and I'm talking about Section 5, the Department of Public Safety's portions of the bill with the State Highway Patrol, the Driver and Vehicle Services. And then I believe that there's some more language for the public safety in regards to fees back in Article 4. And that's why I had a little discussion with Senator Day beforehand, because I think that we need to marry a lot of these provisions into a funding package that comes out of this committee. I mean, I do believe that, and Senator Day, I think that I think that if you would have been here the other day to listen to Congressman Obastar, you would have heard his message that that we will indeed leave federal money on the table if we don't have appropriate resources to match those federal dollars, and that's both in highways and transit. And I would hope that our committee could use several provisions out of the governor's proposal and also marry them with a package that did actually raise the gas tax and a few other fees. I mean, we already have, I don't think fees are off limits. There's plenty of fee increases in here, and I think that a tab fee increase is not out of the question, especially if we put a new schedule out and people who buy cars go on the new schedule, and people who keep driving the ones they have keep paying $35, like the check that I just wrote out today for my truck. So,
Mr. Chairman, remember, I think it was a year or two ago, which it didn't go over very well, but I had the $75 per car used car, and then I had $100 for a new car when somebody bought a new car, and I couldn't believe how I got ground up on that, even though the average price of the new cars in Minnesota is $26,000. And $100, I mean, if you buy a new Camry, the floor mats in the back seat are like $140. So I couldn't imagine that $100 more to drive your car on a good road. But that didn't go too well. But anyway, this is just another approach. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate you.
I think we had a couple questions here left. Yeah. I think we had Senator Bonhoff, Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen, did you have one too? Okay, let's go with Senator Bonhoff first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McFarland, when you talked about the amount of money that would be left from the MBEST revenues, we're talking about, so I understand, 1.8 in bonding, and the total MBEST monies that we collect is 4.3, and including the debt service comes to 2.5. But wouldn't we only have available to us the 60% of the MVEST monies? So
this accounts for, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, the column here represents only the new motor vehicle sales tax revenue that is coming to the trunk highway fund. So it already factors in that the trunk highway fund only gets 60% of that revenue. So it's only trunk highway fund revenues that are in this column.
Okay, so in the 2.5.
In the 2.5.
No, but not
I'm
in the
sorry,
4.3.
I'm sorry. In the 4.3.
Oh, in the 4.3.
That's just a trunk highway fund portion.
That clarifies that. Thank you. And then just a comment. You know, last year I heard this for the first time, and I asked the question. I didn't understand why the governor was recommending more in bonding than even outlined as potential projects. It seemed like if we all are concerned with the heavy debt load, why would you recommend more? And then I remember last year I actually ended up having to vote for it because my project, 494, completing it from 394 up to the Fish Lake Interchange, was one of the identified proposed projects. And I thought, how am I going to go back to my district and say I voted no? And I remember, Senator Day, you even came over to me and said, smart vote. I remember that well. Well, I looked at your proposed projects, and you took that one off this time. So I don't have to vote for the bonds this time.
Well, Senator Bonhoff, I bet they'll put it back in for a vote.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. McFarland,
I greatly appreciate Senator Bonhoff's question because it gives me just a second to talk about the candidate list. The list that you have, you're absolutely correct, Senator, that in the plan that the governor put forth in 2006, it was initially a $2.5 billion bonding package, of which about half of that money was identified in specific projects. The other half which came from our priority list, and the other half was set aside for if the package passed, there would be discussions throughout our ATPs and throughout our districts about prioritizing the remainder of the money that would go to those areas, including the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota. This package is slightly different than that in its structure because, quite frankly, the bonding proposal is smaller. It's a $1.7 billion package, about a little bit over $1.3 billion in specific projects has been identified in this package. The remaining $400 million is we are not describing as being available for future projects and any other priority decisions, but there to cover unexpected cost increases, inflation in these projects, and to help manage the program. Again, I think we've had a very healthy debate over the last couple of years about the role of trunk highway bonding. One of the things we heard from the legislature is you need to provide yourself a little bit of cushion for all kinds of things that might happen in the management of that program. Within the list that is here, your project is sort of there, Senator. Well, let me tell you how. If you look on the last page, the very last page of this list, in the dark area, there's a list of projects in the metropolitan area that have not yet been prioritized. The $1.3 billion package has been divided roughly $650 million. I apologize for the quality of the copy. But $650 million has been programmed or targeted for greater Minnesota, $650 million for the metropolitan area. The two projects in the metropolitan area specified on the list eat up about $380 million. There's $270 million yet to be programmed, probably with these projects, in discussions between MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council's Transportation Advisory Board. What we heard last year when we put that plan together is we got feedback from the Transportation Advisory Board that they would like more input into the prioritization of the metro area's share. So we built in some flexibility in the governor's project proposal for that discussion. And so this is a list of projects that we consider are likely going to be the focus of that discussion should it take place. The tab could bring other projects off this list to that discussion. The point is the discussion will take place, And the two projects from that were on the plan last year, Highway 100 and the 494 project, are both in that category.
Thank you.
You bet. So will you vote for it, Senator?
We'll see what is on it.
Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McFarland, this may turn out to be more of a comment than a question, but it's my understanding that we are looking at bonding so much that we're going into the highway maintenance dollar fund to pay the debt service.
No.
And that the crosstown fiasco, you know, where we asked the contractor to provide the low bid and then, by the way, finance it yourself for 5 years, I mean, we were kind of the laughing stock of the nation on that. I'm a 25-year CDL driver, and I would not be comfortable being put in a snowplow with 2 weeks training to operate one of those rigs. And, I mean, to me, that was one of the biggest safety mistakes I think I've ever heard of. And then as a county commissioner, I sat on a committee for a year looking at access dollars. And the program, the MnDOT guys finally said, we might as well quit meeting. There's no money to do this project. The same area needed a 20-mile repave. It just kept getting moved off and moved off into the future. So what I'm seeing is, and from what I've heard, that you're probably highly responsible for that. And I see it that MnDOT's broken. And I'm going to let you certainly defend yourself, but I see a lot of it's pointing to your leadership in MnDOT. So I'm very upset with the state of transportation in Minnesota. But I guess I do have a question in here somewhere, and that is that I do see Congressman Oberstar bringing us more money than we've ever seen before, and how do we capture that money where we need to have a 25 or 20% match, and there doesn't seem to be, you know, he's been in the Congress for 32 years, you know, I think we could anticipate that he's been bringing home the bacon to our state, and yet that's the biggest thing that we hear him say is that MnDOT, he's fighting MnDOT all the time, so I guess I kind of threw some things out there, but
let me
I feel very
a
strongly on that.
Mr. Chairman, and first off, last year was the largest construction year ever in the state of Minnesota. Every place you went in Minnesota, we were doing construction work. 2 years ago was the second largest. 3 years ago was the third largest. This is 3 years in a row. And as far as Oberstar bringing home the bacon, I've been here 16 years, and I haven't seen the bacon yet. So I've heard, you know, we had the $50 million up north on a highway that I just told you about. Outside of that, in southern Minnesota, from Minneapolis across over St. Paul, if there's been any bacon brought home in the last 16 years, then I think maybe it's went maybe north a little bit, but it sure hasn't come down to my territory. In fact, I don't know of any projects that he's had his hands on in my district to bring anything there, bridges, roads, you name it. So,
well, Senator Day, maybe I can help you with this.
Okay.
Let's see, 04 through 09, $815 million in the Minnesota Surface Transportation Program, the Minnesota Transportation Enhancement Program, $81 million. Minnesota National Highway System, $654 million. Minnesota Interstate Maintenance Program, $534 million. Minnesota Bridge Replacement Rehabilitation, $220 million. $662 million for the Minnesota Equity Program. Information's terrible. This goes on. There's probably 12, 13, 14. There's 14 pages of this, and every page has a little more money on it. And this was the last bill that was passed when he was this was the program when he was the lead minority member on the committee. That was the bacon that he brought home, Senator Day. So I think that
Chairman,
there's rhetoric all over the place here, but
no,
you know, the
rhetoric.
Feds have sent us plenty of money.
That's just general appropriations that the federal government gives us. I mean,
and Senator Day, if Congressman Oberstar had not been there, some of those numbers would have been substantially lower.
I'm telling you, we are now a donor state. We send more money than we get.
We always have been a donor state, Senator Day.
No, we haven't.
Yes, we have. And we're a donor state in many ways, and more than one. And we could go right down to education, health care, you know, the upper Midwest. We're all donors. As a matter of fact, in the middle of May, the Bloodmobile will be here, Senator Day, and you and I can both,
I did it.
Both go
Mr.
donate.
Chairman,
how's
I did
that?
It last time. I felt good. That was good.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
So we can just hold the rhetoric down on both sides of the fence a little bit. But, you know, Congressman Obestar has worked long and hard. We all know that. I think we recognize those efforts, just as we recognize the efforts of a lot of people in this room to try to make transportation a workable situation in this state. And, yes, this administration has put a lot of projects on the ground. I think that there's been some successes. There's also been some areas for pause, and we need to clean up those areas of pause.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, to one point that Senator Olsen made. Senator, first of all, with regard to the package that's in front of you, there is a dedicated stream of new revenue to finance the bonding package the governor has proposed. So no maintenance funds, no additional maintenance funds, or our traditional maintenance funds would be necessary to finance this package. In fact, this package will provide what will allow over $1.8 billion of additional cash revenue not related to bonding to flow to the Trunk Highway Fund that can be used for projects, can be used for maintenance, et cetera. And secondly, as you will hear tomorrow when the budget is discussed, the governor's budget proposes actually increasing, shifting funds from our state road construction program into the maintenance program. And you will see that in the presentation tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. McFarland, I think that the, and none of this is should be construed as being, the personal tit for tat thing. It's just that when organizations that have a lot of very dedicated and knowledgeable people, like the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, comes and says that we're underfunding our road and transit systems by $1.5 billion a year. And, we don't have new revenues on the table, which includes bonding, in my opinion, that gets us at least halfway there. That gives many of us pause. Are we going to get the whole enchilada? No. I've said a couple times that raising $1.5 billion a year using existing revenue streams would probably create some sort of Boston Tea Party. And, so we're not going to go there. But we need to get halfway or three-quarters of the way towards that number. The package that's in front of us takes a step in that direction. I think that we need to marry this proposal along with a couple others that have been kicked around and take the next step and get up, to that $700 million a year figure, or $750 or $800, and try to figure out what the balance is that we can create so that all forms of transportation are addressed. Now, in the governor's recommendations, he recommends, I believe, $6 million for the area that Senator Jungbauer has been pushing, and that's the the aeronautic end of the business. After talking with those people, I think that number needs to probably be $7 or $7.5 million. So there's just a little bit of adjustment all the way through the budget, but I do appreciate the governor's recognition that our state patrol needs some help back there. Our driver and vehicle services need support. These are a couple key functions that many of our constituents depend on every day. In the area of the state patrol, sometimes it's life or death. In vehicle services, it's a frustration level, whether you're getting a driver's license or tabs for your car or whatever. And I think that both those organizations have done a tremendous job in rectifying a couple of identified areas of concern. And so in that regard, I'm glad that the governor has addressed that and has taken the advice, especially when it comes to fees, a fee-based system for our vehicle services. So I think that there's a lot of promise in this proposal. We just need to, you know, instead of having the burner on simmer, we need to kind of crank it up so we can get that pot of water boiling a little bit. Then I think we'll be cooking with gas. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and a question. Senator Day, when you talked about taking the flak for your proposal on adding to the tabs, that's a fee that you pay all at once, and so it's more visible. But I'm not sure the public truly understands where that's going, that they realize that that is a significant contributor. I try every time I have a chance, I talk about the fact that when Governor Ventura gave relief, I mean, at that point, the license tab fees were putting about as much into the Highway User Trust Fund as was the gas tax. People were floored by that. Okay, so you cut a hole in that, and then you leave it to the vagaries of the political process to refill it. And that's where he ran into trouble, and I never quite forgave the governor for not tying his reduction of it to a constitutional amendment like the motor vehicle sales tax, mm-hmm. moving in to fill that hole on a dedicated basis. So it's. I think we've got some educating to do if we go back to trying to sell the license tab fees as to mm-hmm. where that's going, and I would think if people had a better understanding of what that can deliver, maybe it could help make a difference. That's mm-hmm. my comment. The question I have, and I'm not sure how to ask this to be clear, has the department? Do they have a sense of what level of money and project activity in a given year that we have the capacity within the industry to deliver on it before the capacity would be less and therefore actually drive up the cost of the projects? Because if we don't have enough, they could count on getting higher bids because they know there's not anybody else there to do the work.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if I'm misinterpreting how that the response of this of that industry, or if it in fact can expand to no matter what level of dollars that we could commit to projects, they could probably, you know, I mean. Sometimes in some years you think that they're covering every road and that we can't possibly get somewhere without running into road construction. I'm thinking more of the how that might drive some of the inflation, or does it?
Mr. McFarland.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. It is a very good question. It's one we have faced just about every year where there are major transportation funding packages before the legislature. I might defer a bit to friends in the construction industry to answer their, you know, because they're a big part of your question. I will say it's been my impression that I've never seen the construction industry come before the legislature and answer that question by saying there are limits to how many contracts we can bid. So we have not heard of one on the construction industry side.
Pardon me? We haven't
heard of any limits or concerns from the construction industry side that any of the proposals that have been floated before the legislature in years past have ever reached a level where they would have concerns about being able to do the work, having the capacity to do the work. But again, mm-hmm. you might best ask that question of AGC or some of those folks. From MnDOT's side, it's very clear that we have kind of a base staffing, internal staffing, that can deliver a project or a program in the range of $550 to $600 million a year. We've kind of gone through over since 2000 and the $400 million general fund appropriation that occurred under the Ventura administration. The program levels have done a little bit of this. We went up, we went back down, we introduced bonding, it went up. Now it's, you know, as that last 2003 bonding program plays out, it's going down. So we've had some peaks and valleys. We've tried to maintain a MnDOT that can deliver kind of a base program in that $550, $600 million range. The higher you go for shorter periods of time requires greater consultants to help design, engineer, and deliver those projects. Where we might reach a limit in the consulting industry or where we aren't getting good bids on consultant work or on construction work, quite frankly, Senator, I don't know what that limit might be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Olson, we'll have Mr. Werke or somebody from the industry to come and kind of tell you about the peaks and valleys and what kind of havoc that potentially can play in their industry. And I think you would be surprised at some of the gyrations. But Mr. McFarland is right. As long as you have a steady base. It must be time for heroes. No. But as long as you have a steady, with a little bit of growth built into it, funding stream, we don't have the problems of getting the engineers required to do the design. We don't have a problem with getting all the people that it takes to build roads and stuff like that. It doesn't become a problem. But when you go up rapidly and then crash down, it does become a problem, it does become a problem. So the more you can get that kind of flatlined out into the future, the better off we all are. I think Senator Larson had a question, and then I think Senator Day has a motion. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I start with a comment and then a question. And I agree with you. I think that that as you're cooking your transportation proposal in the pot, you ought to throw this in the pot, that this can be one part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And I think it can be, very seriously viewed as a significant tool in the toolbox, if you will. I don't always like using those. But I think it's difficult to do it as the proposal. I think it's hard to have this be the solution. I mean, as I look at this map, Mr. McFarland, and I look at the metro area here, and you gave us some numbers, and I know metro projects are far more expensive to do than projects in greater Minnesota. But, and I try to be a state legislator, not just be parochial, although I think, Congressman Oberstar was right that we have to be careful not to be potted plants, too. We got to fight for our areas. But nonetheless, as I look at my area, I don't see anything on your map. I guess the closest thing is quite a ways down the road on 494. And then I look to the back, and I don't in that list of projects, I don't see anything that really entices me. So as we look at sort of the big picture and the big proposal for our future, for my area, I don't see significant congestion relief occurring with this proposal. And so that's why I think that we need to probably I strongly believe that we need to add more revenue streams to the pot, and that's not a surprise. But the one thing that I want to make sure that I understood from this sheet, because it's different from last year, and that is that my math is correct, and that is the finance cost on the $1.8 billion. Am I right that it's about $800 million, and just the finance cost? Yes. Over the period of the paying off the bonds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, general rule of thumb with 20-year bonds, and this is I've been taught this by the Department of Finance, is the bonding requires about a factor of about 1.5 to retire debt.
Right.
And so that's kind of a rule of thumb, and that'll fluctuate a little bit with interest rates and such. But I want to again, these are – point out the value of bonding on the flip side of your concern about the level of debt service is the, especially in periods of high construction inflation and low interest rates, you can save significant amounts of money over the long term by bringing the projects forward, spending the dollars today, and paying for them and beating inflation over time. The Crosstown project, which has been brought up, one of the reasons we put the Crosstown project out last year in a difficult circumstance and hoped to get bids and hoped that innovation would work was principally to avoid 1 year of inflation on that project. And there were a lot of factors that led to the decision and the contract structure, and I won't go into those here. But our fear came true. We were trying to let a $255 million project. It wasn't successful in the fashion we proposed it. And now we're a year later. We have the project out to bid, and we're likely looking at $285 million because of a year of inflation. If we can bring these projects forward quickly and beat inflation and pay with cheaper dollars over the long haul and deliver benefits to the traveling public and reduce congestion, improve safety, all of which, as Senator Murphy has mentioned many times, have economic costs to them, we can be ahead of the game.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. McFarland, I appreciate that. And I think, there's probably two perspectives on, the contractor financing. I know, it was proposed as innovation, and to some as innovation, from my perspective, it was more desperation. I mean, that project is in the middle of my district, and I could consider that sort of a success in all of this if we put that on the map. But we've been waiting so long for that that it's overdue. And I guess from my perspective, we could solve the problem of not having to wait till next year if MnDOT had enough discretionary ability and funds to draw on. And I see some folks shaking their head in the background. That's fine. We've got plenty of – I know in that world we must have plenty of transportation dollars. And I'm glad that you feel that way. But at least folks in my district are wondering is, how come we don't make a greater commitment to transportation? And I don't mean that as a partisan statement, a political statement at all. But I think the question when we can't build projects that have been online to go forward and we don't have the funds to send them out to bid, that's a real problem. And so it seems to me if we had the additional gas tax revenue, we have some additional flexibility for the administration to move forward on some of these. And there are some more dots on the state. And I know those decisions are difficult. I understand that. I voted for the bill in 2005 for $7.5 billion. And so it's I know those aren't easy decisions to make to tax people. On the other hand, I think that's where we've gotten to, I think, people's willingness to pay to have some relief. I guess the other thing that I just wanted clarification on, and as you had talked earlier about the governor's program on mileage, it was sort of my sense that the governor, and I was excited about this and hearing about it, because I know some of the work that they've been doing in Oregon, and yet I'm a little concerned that it sounded tonight like you were saying maybe the governor doesn't ever see Minnesota actually stepping out from an implementation standpoint, but really is just trying to lead the federal government to do it first. And that concerns me because I have a lot of skepticism about how quickly the federal government is going to get ahead of us on that. But I just wanted to give you an opportunity to clarify that.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, I think it's very in Oregon and Washington, who are running pilots themselves, I think recognize this as well. It is going to be very difficult for any state to unilaterally implement a mileage-based taxation system because it will then be running two separate transportation funding systems. We'll maintain the structure of the federal gasoline tax that would be gas tax based, and then a structure of mileage based taxation in that state. The problem with a state unilaterally pursuing mileage based taxation is how do you account for interstate travel? How do you account for differences in technologies that states might employ? It really has to be, when implemented in the future, it has to be a nationally compatible system to replace the nation's and the individual state's gas tax-based system. Otherwise, you're going to have lots of confusion on interstate travel. You're going to have a lot of confusion on interstate trucking. You're going to have a lot of confusion on different technologies. If the state of Wisconsin were to go out and do mileage-based taxation with an entirely different type of technology than the state of Minnesota or the state of South Dakota, we're going to have problems. So I think I should say it's not that a unilateral action is completely out of the question, but I think most research on this issue and most advice from centers of transportation studies and others that have looked at these issues has been that eventually it's going to have to be a national change in how we implement taxes for travel, mm-hmm. moving from gas tax to mileage base.
All right, we're getting the sign from the back of the room that we should be wrapping it up. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, there was a comment made here on some of the congestion things, and I realize these major projects, particularly in the metro area, work toward that end. But it seems to me that there are some little, smaller things that can actually work to reduce congestion, and two of them that were done that come to mind were what you did on 394 between Louisiana and 169. Both morning and night, when that's heavily traveled, you can tell the difference. It was, I think, a relatively small investment by standards of the you know, huge projects that we're doing. And another thing that comes to mind was the 100, you know, the Twin West Chamber businesses have been very concerned about Highway 100, and there was one chunk that was left undone that was kind of a bottleneck, and yet you did whatever you did, you can drive through there and you could hardly notice that it wasn't completed all the way through because you made some changes, whether it was just the lane width or whatever, that just at least provided a relief valve. How long is your list of other little things like that around the area that could actually be done and relieve congestion with a relatively modest amount of money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I can tell you we're very cognizant of looking for opportunities for low-cost solutions that increase traffic flow and reduce congestion. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, if I could, I know our metro district has more details on some of the things and the specific projects that they're looking at that have that potential. And if I could, Senator, defer that question to another committee hearing where our metro programming people or Mr. Our metro district engineer could come and address some of that for the senator and the committee. That would I would probably step all over myself with mistakes if I tried to account for them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that Tom O'Keefe is coming to see me this week, and I think maybe that's something I will ask him then.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And Senator Olson, I'm glad you mentioned the 394 project. When Senator Rest and I and Representative Earhart were out in Washington at this meeting with the Secretary of Transportation, the 394 project was held up along with the I-15 project running north out of San Diego as being prime examples that congestion pricing can actually work. Unfortunately, those successes were downplayed at the federal level in light of trying to open up toll roads everywhere. And, you know, congestion pricing is completely different than toll roads. I think that Minnesota has, Minnesotans, especially out in your guys' neck of the woods, you and Senator Bonner, have a good idea of what congestion pricing can do. And I would hope that in the future that we can work some language into our bills so that if we are adding lanes of capacity to whether it's 94 or either one of the 35s, that we do enlist some sort of congestion pricing on those lanes. Because it does work. It helps curb that increase in congestion and can actually loosen up some congestion. One of the things that I was amazed at was almost 40% of those vehicle rides during rush hour don't need to be out there. There are people who are going to the grocery store or they're going to the doctor or, you know, they're doing something other than commuting and going to work. And studies indicate that if you can get if you can get someplace even south of 9% of the cars off the road that are in that classification, that you will improve your capacity by 25%. 9 equals 25. And I think that we need to do some, you know, some more things, congestion pricing and some of these other mechanisms to help with these traffic patterns, because, you know, which would, and the other big thing is to talk with large business owners that have, you know, 500, 800 employees all in one location to maybe stagger their start and quit time so that they're not out there, so that their employees are not out there at the same time. And if we can work all these things together along with a well-funded and balanced package, you know, once again, I think we'll be cooking with gas. But, you know, well,
just on that point,
oh, okay,
though,
go ahead.
Just to clarify that, I think it would, part of it came up with a discussion that we had that when that was first opened, it was 24/7 going both directions, mm-hmm. on that one part, and it was really actually causing a jam. And what they did is because there's as much traffic coming out in the morning in that area as there is going in. And so by lifting and not charging for the extra lane, and then they had some few bucks left over from installing that they used to actually, instead of on the shoulder, improve that and add an extra lane on the, mm-hmm. and not have it exit between Louisiana and 169. And the combination of that really did work. So there are things like that. But I do agree. I think listening to them and seeing what has happened when the tinkering and the bugs have gotten out of that, I think that it is ineffective. It made a believer out of me. I was a bit cynical, but I think it is working.
I think a lot of the people out in your neck of the woods are probably happy that did something a little different, because that was a mess for the longest time. Yeah. But Senator Larson, on page 87 of the project's description for performance-based and physically constrained planning investment needs, Appendix A of another BNDOT, there's actually a bunch of projects in here in your district in regards to some 494 work and Trunk Highway 77, 62, and the time frame needed was 2015 to 2023. Now, Mr. McFarland, here's what gets under the gizzard of Senator Larson, is that the time frame planned, those blanks are blank. And so, you know, they're time frame needed versus time frame planned. You know, you go through the whole document and you see that there's a lot of blank spots in the time frame planned, and we want to fill those up. And I think that if we marry a bunch of these bills together, we're going to hit these and hopefully accelerate, because there's some of these that are on here, like for 2015 to 2023, that we know should be, I mean, we should have Mr. Werke's group out there digging the dirt right now. I mean, that's just the way it is. There's not enough money to get all these projects done, but I think that if we kind of put the shoulder to the wheel, we'll get there. So.
Mr. Chair, I knew I was in trouble when you said I was on page 87.
Well, I'm back on page like 102, so I. But and Highway 14 is not on here,
Mr.
Senator
Chairman. It was on there for 40 years before, but. Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, sometimes I wish. See, I came to the dance with these guys, so I can't tell you about how I'd like to get the chainsaw and go out on the ramp meter lights, and I'd like to revamp the same lanes, and I got a lot of stuff that I'd like to do. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, if it would be all right with you, I would like to lay this bill on the table.
Okay.
That'd be all right?
Yep, that'd be fine, Senator Day. On Senator Day's motion to lay Senate File 541 on the table, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Committee members, be watching your schedules now over the next couple weeks. Things are going to happen fast. Thank you, and the committee is adjourned.